Introduce yourself, please.
Senator Jim Denning. I represent District 8 in Overland Park.
My, we have a lot of news this past week to talk to you about, but first we'll hear the open. This is State House Blend. I'm Sam Zeff. We're using coffee and donuts to help us better understand the historic legislative session underway in Topeka. The issues and the people in the Kansas legislature. Here we go. Joining Jim and me today in the KCUR 89.3 production studio is my Kansas News Service bunkie, Jim McLean. Always good to have you at this table.
Hi, Sam.
Before we push forward, Jim, with the budget, taxes, and school finance, I want to get an update on your grandkids, your pets, and I'm now adding a third standard question to the podcast. Have you met with the Russian ambassador?
I have not met with the Russian ambassador. Grandkids are growing up quickly. Two of them actually have driver's license now, and the oldest is in college. So, yeah, the grandkids are sprouting up, doing well, and actually driving, if you can believe that. Pets, we've added two cats to the household, and there was a lady that was going into the convent that needed to give up her two rescue cats. So Meryl took them, so we've got two cats added to the family.
Your wife, Meryl, and what are the names of the cats?
Lucy and Ellie.
Oh, I thought it was going to be Lucy and Ricky, but that just shows how old I am. We're going to divide State House Blend into two parts today. First, the budget and what we might have to cut, and then and taxes and what we might have to raise. And I want to transition into the Gannon ruling and any new school funding formula that's coming down the pike. But I want to start with Jim's first question for Senator Denning.
Well, I think you all have been off for about a week, and you're coming back, and there's, of course, a lot to do and a short amount of time to do it. But you really have to start with the budget issues, and you don't yet have a balanced budget in the current fiscal year, nor do you have one in the coming year. So what's first up when you get back? You came within three votes of overriding the bill that would have raised income taxes, repealed the LLC exemption. Are you going to turn your attention initially to a slightly different version of that bill? What's going to happen?
Yeah, I'd personally like to see the caucus continue to work on budget and tax. Now that we've had a tax bill come across the floor, that would be House Bill 2178, it raised about $450 million in new taxes. And then when you circle back around and look at the governor's proposal, he raised a similar amount. Not through taxes, but through one-time money, securitizing tobacco, and then not making CAPERS payment. And then if you go look at amended Senate Bill 147, it raises about $450 million as well. So I think the House working independently, the Senate working independently, and the governor working independently, we've all arrived at the fact that we need $450 million in new taxes to structurally balance the budget and get Kansas back on sound financial footing. So again, everybody did their own analysis and we all came back to $450 million. So that's about half of the deep tax cuts that we did in 2012. So after those cuts were made, we're 4 years into it. We know they were too deep. They didn't produce the economic growth that we thought they would do. We can't cut government expenses deep enough to match up with the lower revenue income that we get from those lower taxes. We're in a rural recession, and the U.S. economy up until now has been anemic at best. So it appears that we need to take back 50% of those deep tax cuts to get Kansas back on sound financial footing.
And you said an awful lot there, I mean, because you live this on a daily basis on the floor as the majority leader in the Senate. But the big issue here is we're talking about the tax increases really for the next fiscal year because they can't kick in quite clearly. But the big issue is the fact that the governor vetoed that bill. I mean, you're right. He came up with an alternative way to raise the money, but he vetoed the tax bill you all passed. You came within three votes of overriding that veto. So what's it going to take to get those final three votes?
Yeah, I think what it's going to take in the Senate side is, you know, that House bill had payroll withholding taxes retroed back to January 1st, and that has to come out. So once that comes out, I think the Senate will be in a position to vote for the tax bill and override if necessary.
Does that affect the amount of raises?
Well, yes and no. Every single tax bill that has been produced has no fiscal effect for FY17. Mm-hmm. Even with the retro, there was no fiscal effect for FY17. But with the retro, it certainly raises more in fiscal year 18, which is – that's the problem year. That's mm-hmm. actually the bridge year. Even though we have a $350 million deficit in FY17, that will easily be overcome by using that one-time PMIB money
right.
to the tune of $350 million. So 17 deficit solved. It's 18 that's the bridge year. And then when you look at 19 with the taxes in place, we return to some very sound financial footing.
I want to make sure that – so retroactivity was a problem for – a big problem for you, certainly for Senate President Susan Weigel. The rest of the Senate seemed to be okay with the bill. So if they strip out retroactivity, that brings you, Weigel, and at least one other vote across the line if the governor vetoes again.
I believe that to be true. And what you have to remember is that there was already talk – of running a trailer bill, if 2178 would have passed to strip out that retroactivity, so there was already enough discomfort with it about it being bad policy that there was already talk of a trailer bill to do that. So the reason why I dug in was that I wanted the bill to come through with the retro out, so everybody can look at fiscal year 18 and solve it up front rather than later. I'd rather do it sooner than later. I've been through this budget and tax battle for many years, and I think it's time to get everything truly on the table, look at it realistically, what it looks like in 18, and address 18 head on.
Yeah. I want to move on to Gannon in just a second, but a couple things that you said I want to follow up on. So you refer to keep saying 2018 is a bridge year, which sort of sounds to me like we all are going to have to endure another fiscal year of some pain. People are not going – the budget is not going to be as robust or as generous as perhaps folks would like. So is that what we're looking at, that we all have to weather fiscal year 2018 before, you know, the sun is shining again?
Which starts on July 1st right. of this year.
Yeah, I think that's right. All the modeling that we've done, fiscal year 18 for the state of Kansas starts this July 1st. And that's why the House wanted to retro payroll taxes back to January 1st. Because they're, you know, they know that fiscal year is a tough year, so when you do any payroll taxes going forward, they're going to start January 1st of 18, but our fiscal year starts January 1st of 17 for fiscal year 18. So it's very complicated.
Got that, everybody?
And that's the transition. So we're only going to get 6 months of actual tax help in fiscal year 18 because it starts in just a few months. So we are going to have to keep our belts tightened in 18. There's a few things we can do. Obviously, we're going to take that PMIB money. The receipts are a little better if we don't have to give it back from that tax dispute that was reported yesterday. And we can reamortize CAPERS a bit. That will keep it actuarially sound. And there's been some talk on the Senate side to see if the schools would be willing to use some of their reserve money to help us get through fiscal year 18. At one time, we thought we had the votes for that, but the caucus fell apart on that. And you know, I honestly don't know if we have the votes to ask the schools to help us get through 18 by using some of their reserves or not. But we can get through 18 without additional budget cuts. It's just a very tight year, and we're basing that on a 1.1% growth rate. So that should be doable. With the receipts from the end of February, we came in at plus 0.5% growth rate. So we're getting there. They projected a minus 1.13 for fiscal year 17. So we're actually in the positive side, and that's where you're seeing those enhanced monthly revenues come in. So I think the projections are pretty sound, but 18 it's the transition year to get Kansas back on a good financial footing.
I mean, you want to get to a point where you're not taking money from, where you're making your CAPERS payments, you're not taking money from KDOT. And what I'm hearing is that we can look forward to that in fiscal year 2019.
You can see it really firming up, really from a financial perspective. The budget and tax scenario really firms up nicely in 19. It has a positive trend. We're close to a 2% ending balance. And when you take it out to 20 and 21 using a very low growth rate, you can see how healthy Kansas can get.
So how does all of this get complicated and muddied and maybe increase your intake of aspirin with this recent Gannon ruling?
Well, obviously, it does get complicated. We were hoping to solve the budget and tax before the ruling came down. We didn't want another variable in play. And I'm asking the caucus on Tuesday to stay the course. Let's take this in bites. Let's go ahead and fix the structure in the budget with a Senate bill 147 or a House Bill 2178 or a flat tax, whatever the caucus feels more comfortable going forward. We know it has to raise $450 million, so we've at least accomplished the financial component. We just haven't figured out the structure yet, but we're very close to that. So I'm asking the caucus on Tuesday to stay the course. Let's complete our work on budget and tax and shift immediately to school finance and sort through the formula and see what it looks like and then take another bite if we have to.
So just to make sure that I understand, you're gonna pretend just for a little bit that the Supreme Court ruling hasn't come down. You're going to do what you intended to do, solve the budget deficit issue in the current fiscal year and the next fiscal year. And then move on and take a look at the new school finance formula that will be being worked on, and then put a price tag on that, and then figure out how you're going to raise that money once you know that?
That's correct. You know, I don't want to pretend that the ruling didn't come down, because it did come down, and it's good that it did. It gave a lot of clarity to what we need to do on the formula. So not pretend that it came down, but not introduce it as another variable.
You just set it aside momentarily in terms of figuring out how you're going to raise the money, right?
Right. We have to write the formula first, mm-hmm. and then we'll decide where the monetary piece fits in. The Supreme Court was very clear on this ruling that it wants equity and adequacy solved, but it's up to the legislative body to decide the monetary number to that. They're just going to make us accountable on the adequacy for sure. And we'll have to make the Board of Education accountable on whatever programs they come out with.
So it sounds like you're not really you don't view the ruling negatively. You think it was an even-handed kind of fair ruling, and the court stayed in its lane and allowed you to do the same.
I do. The obviously the courts were very clear on equity, so we know what that looks like. As far as adequacy goes, they were very clear that one fourth of the students in Kansas are not meeting Rose standards for one reason or another. And we circle back to free and reduced at-risk kids, and we circle back to English as second learners or second language, ESL kids, as the group. But there are kids that are in that group and outside that group that are not meeting the Rose standards. And the Supreme Court's very clear that they're depending on the Rose standards as the adequacy bar, and they want targeted money targeted programs to get that subgroup, which represents 25% of all the kids in Kansas, they want them marching towards meeting the Rose standards. That's our marching orders. And that's where the targeted money and targeted programs have to be directed. And it's very clear that that's what they want. Did they give us any direction on how to get there? No, they didn't. So that's the hard piece of the formula that we're going to have to write policy in and actually fund it. But what's interesting is they're basing this thing on outcomes. So they're no longer comfortable with awaiting for this population. In the old days of the old formula, you just add another weighting and say, problem solved. The Supreme Court says those days are over. We want to see the outcomes from that additional money. So very different problem-solution combination.
Mm-hmm. Jim, I want to make sure that I'm hearing you right, and that is you think that there's going to have to be some additional money put into education. You're not suggesting that you can just shift current resources around to solve this particular problem that the Supreme Court highlighted in the decision.
Yeah. Again, I've worked on the school finance a bit over the summer, and I think there's two things that we have to look at. We have to look at the district piece, that is to say the input piece. Districts will need funding for operating expenses, that is to say increased salaries, increase or decrease in enrollment, healthcare costs, utilities costs. You have to have a finance formula in place to cover those inputs. And that is going to require more money. We've had the schools in block grants for 2 years, and coming up to there since 2006, following the deep recession, you know, schools have been held fairly flat. So there is going to have to be additional money for inputs. And then when you shift to adequacy with this 25% of the kids that aren't meeting Rose, the court's very clear that they want directed money targeted to that group. So having said that, then you have to back up and look at the population trends. Since we put the schools in block grants, we've lost 3,500 kids. So when you go back to a formula where you're basically starting per pupil, there's probably going to be 15 to 20 million that is available because we have fewer students. And then you can offset that with whatever you need for higher inputs for districts and higher inputs for that subgroup of kids that aren't performing up to Rose standards.
One quick follow-up to that. So there have been estimates that it could take up to $800 million to satisfy adequacy. The State Department of Education had a much lower figure, $535 million. Where are you on how much more money you think it's going to take?
I don't know the answer to that. I would imagine when you do your inputs, it'll probably start around $200 million and go north from there. That's a very preliminary number. Once we get into the formula and start looking at this adequacy thing, it could change. But the courts will get – I hope I'm not talking out of school here, but in 92 when they switched the formula, the courts gave the legislature 5 years to get up to speed. I think coming through this deep recession, this tax policy since 12, I think the courts need to give us a bit longer runway if we're going to be successful. We need to show early commitment and consistent commitment. The old formula was a failure from the get-go. It was never fundable, and it sure as heck wasn't sustainable. I think since 2006, after the last recession, the base aid was only funded 25% of the time. So we know that type of input-only formula is not going to work. So we have to have a formula that we can actually afford and consistently fund every single year. That's a really hard task to accomplish, but that's what the schools need. They don't need one out of four times of getting budget. They need four out of four times of getting their budget money.
Do you have any idea at this point? You say $200 million is a starting point. Once you have pass the revenue-raising measures that you think you need to do to balance the budget in this year and this fiscal year, where do you think you can go to get that additional money should once you determine how much it's going to be?
Yeah, I think when you drop in the tax policy changes, and even if you stay at low growth of 2% or below, when you look at those out years, you'll see that the state gets on good financial footing and we can start ticking off the amount we need to put into schools to get them healthy again and, again, address that adequacy.
So you're saying that the tax bills you're already contemplating passing, if you have a long enough runway, just those changes alone will start generating the additional money you might need?
It will. And then the other important thing that the Supreme Court did was that it disagreed with the lower court. The Supreme Court says that local option budget money and federal money are certainly part of the adequacy number. So I think that's where a lot of confusion gets. There was an old number of like 4,600 in base aid, mm-hmm. and I think everybody's using that. But the Supreme Court was very clear that part of that 4,600 is already being solved by the LOB, the federal money, and even a bit of CAPERS, they said that that would be allowed. So I think that's where the confusion comes, is that we're at 3,600 now, and it's 4,600 in the piece of paper, so 1,000. That's based on not including any LOB credit towards it. So LOB generates about $1 billion a year that the lower court would not allow as part of adequacy, and the higher court is. So I'm not paying too much attention to that. What I want to do when we get back is write a formula that funds the districts, and then a component of the formula that funds the kids that aren't performing up to Rose standards. So two different inputs, district, which is the operational piece, and then the individual piece for the kids that aren't performing up to Rose.
One real quick follow-up, and Sam knows this in detail, and you are aware of this as well, but in terms of the equity issues, one of the big things with the LOB is its
that's local option budget,
which is
local property taxes that are levied by school districts.
Yes, exactly, and the ability of local of taxing districts across the state to raise money is very. People always say, you know, Johnson County versus Galena, where one mill or Burlington, where one mill raises X number of dollars there. If you go down to Galena, it raises significantly less. And if you allow the LOB to be too much of a component of the basic funding formula, that's disequalizing over time. Do you have concerns about that?
No, I think we sorted that out last year with the ruling on the equity side. You know, we equalize LOBs under the old environment. So the courts were comfortable with how we solved it. At the end, the schools didn't get much of the money because most of it was property tax relief, but it was still the formula. That's just another flaw that we have to look at going forward. But I think LOBs, there was a lot of discussion. Would the courts frown on LOBs or smile on LOBs? And right now it appears that they're accepting LOBs as part of the adequacy. There's a lot of formula changes that could occur. There's one coming out of Johnson County that actually takes the LOB and rolls it into the state-based aid amount, the old calculation, and that brings it up to almost $8,200.
So per pupil.
And it gets really confusing when you just look at that base aid number of 3,600. A lot of folks think that that is the per pupil funding when it's between 8,000 and 10,000 because of the 10 to 14 weightings that get piled onto it. Mm. So going in, if one could look at a higher equity base aid number or equity or adequacy base aid number, including some of the LOB, way less weightings, I think it'd give the whole school formula transparency a big lift.
I want to talk a little bit about how you're going to get to that solution, but I wanted to go back real quickly and just ask you about what you said before about districts being willing to use some of their reserve funds to get through the next fiscal year. I think districts would argue that that is, in fact, a cut. that they're being asked to use money that they have in the bank that they may need to use to bridge certain projects or pay for special education because of the crazy way that money gets distributed throughout the year. So are you telling districts right now that they need to prepare for their fiscal year 2018 to dig into their reserve funds?
I would like the schools to give us a hand. It would bring a lot of structure and closure to the process. I know it's a big ask, but on the other side, the legislature would be willing to give more local spending authority on their capital outlay. That is to say, allow capital outlay to pay for utilities and property casualty insurance. That would more than offset the amount that they would give up on the reserve. So there's give and take, and I don't know even if the body's even interested in asking anymore, but if the schools could help us get through fiscal year 18 by using some of their reserves, and in return we let them use their capital outlay money, which is a total different silo, to pay for all of their utilities and all of their property casualty while we get through this, I think it's a win-win for almost everybody. If legislative research is accurate, there's only 6 schools that would not benefit from that maneuver. So I'll leave it up to the schools and the body to decide that. We're going to get through fiscal year 18 the easy way or the hard way. That's the easy way, but there's a hard way, and we'll do it. We've got to get through 18 so we can get to 19.
The hard way would be actual cuts to K through 12.
Well, I think the hard way would be not making – the House's position is not making the very first PMIB payment. They want to cut capers. I would reamortize with the layering effect to keep it actuarially sound. So those are the things that are in play. And just over the last couple of days, when the body realized that retroactivity was dead on arrival, they've even thought about using some of the cigarette tax in the original governor's budget that we poo-pooed. There's some circling around to maybe using the cigarette tax to get through 18. A lot of clever, bright people in the body, and everybody's thinking about what's the best way to get through 18. So a lot of clever people, a lot of smart people, and we'll figure it out.
Can we expect the solution to come out of a broad, not coalition, but a broad group of people, the way you solved equity, brought everybody into the room, moderates, conservatives, Republicans, Democrats, even the education community. Can we expect that sort of cooperation to fix adequacy?
Yeah, that's the makeup of the body. And we know we have to compromise on both sides. We've got to get 21 votes in the Senate, 63 votes in the House, and everybody wants to come up with a solution. They ran on it. The guys like myself that have lived through this hell for 4 years, we are ready to
get out
this
of purgatory
thing behind
or hell,
us.
Yeah.
All right. Yep. Well, and let me just follow up on that and say and ask. It's clear that you're going to bring in people from the legislature, but the way equity got solved, as well as you brought in folks from the education community, the plaintiffs' attorneys, all became part of the conversation, thus the solution. Are you going to go to that extent?
Yes, we really already have. There's been, starting over the turnaround break, there's been lots of meetings with educators and superintendents. So that process has already started. They're coming up to Topeka with several meetings with delegations. So, yeah, everybody's on board. They see the light at the end of the tunnel, and they know it's not a train. So everybody wants to help. And we're going to get this thing solved. And at the end of the day, the governor will help us.
You think the governor will be part of the solution and not be an obstacle?
I think at the end of the day, he will help us get through this and not be an obstacle. Even if it means staying on the sidelines, then that's a step in the right direction. But I do think he'll give us a hand.
Might the best thing be for the governor to stay on the sidelines?
It depends on if he will allow the process to work, which means raising about $450 million in new taxes. letting the LLC loophole get closed, maybe revisit that at another time and put it back to legislative intent. But that opportunity has passed. If he can let that go and realize that we have to raise $450 million to get us back on sound financial footing, if he'll support those two things, either by helping us or just not getting involved, that will be a benefit.
Jim McLean, your final thought or question?
Well,
for
just the last
Senator
question, and this just occurred to me as I was listening to the senator talk. The governor was critical of the. You were not critical of the ruling. The governor was, and one of the things, one of the elements he threw into his statement was the whole question about school choice, and you know, using public tax money to help. Kids, some of the kids who are struggling, it was mentioned in the ruling, transfer out of public schools and into charter schools and private schools, et cetera. How much will that be an issue, and how much of it could it be a wrench in the proceedings if that becomes a big part of the debate?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, obviously, the governor's a big choice. The president's, Senator Wagle's a big choice person. Yeah, I think the public, I think there's more support for choice than one would think, but we have to solve this. I don't want another variable thrown in. If choice brings more votes than it loses, then by all means. But if choice brings less votes than it gains, then let's let it set.
You don't want it to get in the way of any solution?
I don't. This thing needs to get solved by June 30. And again, if choice brings more votes than it loses, fine and dandy. But if it loses more votes than it brings, let's let it set.
You don't have a fear that you're not going to meet that deadline, do you?
No, we made a commitment, you know, 2 years ago that we would be writing the formula. So we'll make the deadline. I made a commitment that when we got back from turnaround that we were going to shift our resources to school finance. And that was before the Supreme Court ruling came down. I feel like the budget and tax has been basically resolved. We have to raise $450 million in new revenue and figure out how to get through 18. So I think the big lift is done, and the body's going to have to decide on the structure of what a tax policy looks like to raise 450 and what to do with 18. But I think the big lift's done, and again, I made the commitment to the caucus that I'm personally moving on to school finance when we return from turnaround, which is this coming Monday.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to my KCUR colleague, Jim McLean. Always a pleasure to have you at this table in Kansas City.
Thank you, Sam, and thank you, Senator.
Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you do your podcast business. You can also find us at kcur.org/statehouseblend. Got that NPR One app? You should. And if you do, search for Statehouse Blend and explore, and then click subscribe. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Sam Zeff. And my Statehouse Blend Missouri co-host, Brian Ellison, who keeps track of the Michigas over there in Missouri, is at PTS Brian. I'm Sam Zeff. I'll see you around the radio.